One night, I dreamed that I crawled into my mother's bed on Cherry Street and heard her mutter a name or a word that sounded like Reinhardt. My worries subsided, though the underlying anxiety surfaced if I was doing something that reminded me of her, like washing the dishes or listening to Billie Holiday on WBGO. At the start of the third week in May, I asked for all my accumulated sick leave on the grounds of a family emergency. My boss told me to take as much time as I needed and to keep in touch. I didn't think I was going anywhere in particular. At the same time, I knew exactly where I was going and why. At the moment Star was boarding the Greyhound, I was in the cab of a 16-wheeler bound for Flagstaff, enjoyably discussing the condition of African Americans in the United States with its driver, Mr. Bob Mims. And my defenses collapsed, and the truth rushed in. Star had used the last of her strength to get herself home, and I was going there to be with her when she died. Once Bob Mims found out why I wanted to get to Edgerton, he veered from his normal route to take me to the Motel Comfort south of Chicago on the interstate. After an hour of waving my thumb at the side of the highway, I gave up trying to get to Edgerton that night and checked into the motel. All the car rental agencies were closed for the night. I went to the bar and started talking to a young assistant DA from Louisville named Ashley Ashton, who was on maybe her second sea breeze. After a while, I walked her through what seemed a half mile of empty corridors. She gave me a quizzical, questioning look when she unlocked her door, and I followed her in. "What's your story, anyhow, Ned Dunstan? I hate to bring it up, but your clothes look like you've been hitchhiking." I gave her a short-form answer that implied that I had learned of my mother's illness while hitchhiking for pleasure on a whim. If I had a car, I could get to Edgerton tonight. "Edgerton? Well, that's where I'm going." Suspicion rose into her eyes for a moment, and then she realized that I could not have known of her destination. "If we're still speaking to each other tomorrow morning, I could give you a ride." "Why wouldn't we be speaking to each other?" "I don't know. Don't guys hate the idea of waking up beside someone they don't know? Or get disgusted with themselves because they think the woman's cheap? It's a mystery to me. I haven't had sex in a year. 13 months, to be exact. The charming process of getting divorced from my husband, I suppose. I found out he was screwing half his female clients." She sat on the edge of the bed and took off her nice lady lawyer shoes. "I'm in this stupid mood. I can see my case going down the drain. Now that I'm being indiscreet, you've probably heard of the guy we're after. He's one of Edgerton's leading citizens, Stuart Hatch. Tons of money." "We didn't move in those circles," I said. "You should be grateful. I'll never understand why a guy with so much going for him would decide to turn into a crook." About 5:45 in the morning, I jumped out of bed before I was fully awake. Aunt Nettie's sixth sense was operating at full strength. I had to get to Edgerton in a hurry. "Ashley, wake up. I have to get to Edgerton fast." She opened an eye. "Oh, yeah. Edgerton." Ashley sailed down the nearly empty highway at a comfortable 65, then glanced at me. "I hope she'll be all right." "I'm just glad you were there." "Well, I am, too. I think you should probably go around the country giving hope to depressed women. And you were so tactful, you never made anything seem prearranged."
"Prearranged?"
"Well, maybe not prearranged, but you know, from Chicago with my law school friend, Mandy." As we talked, the story emerged. In the bar of a Chicago hotel, Mandy, the law school friend, had sent me a drink. When I left my chair to thank them, Mandy invited me to sit down. To Mandy's chagrin, I had seemed more interested in Ashley than herself. Not long after, Ashley had inserted the Motel Comfort into our conversation, and I had expressed the hope of returning the favor and buying her a drink in whatever passed for a bar in the place if I wound up there too. I told Mandy you'd never show up, but she said to go to the bar an hour or two after you check in, and he'll find you. Apparently, someone who looked a lot like me had been cruising the lobby of a Chicago hotel. No other rational explanation seemed possible. At the same time, the sheer unlikeliness of the coincidence prickled the hairs at the nape of my neck. At the sign for Edgerton Center, she spun the little car off the highway. Four blocks later, she pulled up before St. Anne's Community Hospital. She stayed in the car while I took my bags from the trunk. I came up to kiss her goodbye. If you were going to ask where I'm staying, Ned, it's Merchant's Hotel, wherever that is. At the information desk, a woman told me that there was no patient named Star Dunstan, but that Valerie Dunstan was in intensive care. Numb with dread, I wandered through dingy hospital corridors to the intensive care unit. Dunstan, I said. Star Dunstan. Sorry, Valerie Dunstan. The nurse bent her head to examine a clipboard. Room 15. Aunt Nettie was already surging toward me. Oh, great beings and inhuman ancestors. Only days before the prison walls of the Academy's 8th grade were to close around me, I came to a break in the woods in an overgrown field extending toward a road I did not know. Between the top of the field and the curve of the woods was a 3/4 crumbled building of brick and stone. The instant I beheld these remains, the hook in my entrails nearly yanked me off my feet, and a voice from within or without boomed, "Come at last. You are here." I placed my trembling hands on the gritty sill and looked within. Dusty particles filtered down to a cement floor littered with plaster, broken pipes, and charred timbers. I jumped, grabbed the far side of the sill with both hands, and squirmed forward until I could get my legs under the flat stone sill. Then I lowered myself to the floor and entered my inheritance for the first time. Or my inheritance entered me. You who read the words I hear inscribe already know the significance of the ruined house to your great race. An elder god spoke, and I learned all. Half human, half god, I was the opener of the way, and my task was annihilation. After me, the apocalypse, the entry to a riven sky of my leathery, winged, clawed, ravenous ancestors, the elder gods, the destruction of mankind. The mighty voice said, "We are the smoke from the cannon's mouth." I could certainly have gotten away scot-free if I had killed Maureen Orth, which was what I had in mind for her once I got the sex part out of the way. In the meantime, I couldn't help myself. A number of insecure maidens accompanied me into the woods to end their pointless lives on the floor of my classroom. I did go to the trouble of interring most of the bodies, but I might as well have let them rot. The search parties never came near the ruins. In any case, I had outgrown this sort of exhibitionism by the time I was thrown out of Edgerton Academy. Military school, in my case, good old fortress of Owlsburg, Pennsylvania, to which my father sent me in a last convulsion of disgust, suited me far better than its civilian imitations. Because I entered in the senior or cavalry year, one of my duties was to bully the students beneath me. I spent one of the happiest years of my young life in that place. On the Thursday of the week given over to the examinations before the Christmas break, I saw Artillery Pledge Fletcher immersed in a book at a long table in the library. Fletcher was perusing a brightly jacketed work of fiction, The Dunwich Horror. The combination of the title and the lurid cover illustration instantly struck me with a lesser version of that force which had first drawn me into Johnson's Woods. I had to have that book. When Fletcher stood up, I collected my things and rushed alongside him. "Yes," he said, "he would be happy to loan me the book after he had finished reading it." He surrendered it for inspection with the comment that it was really spooky. At 5:30 on Friday afternoon, while on his way to mess hall, Fletcher entered my room without pausing to knock. He found me in, so to speak. I was making my first baby steps toward moveless movement, whatever it's called, disappearing from one place and turning up in another. By Christmas break of that year, I had succeeded in shifting myself across the 4 feet from the edge of my cot to my desk chair by means of a sweaty interlude during which I was neither in one place or the other, but in both, imperfectly. Whatever that looked like while it was happening is what Fletcher saw when he barged into my room. I saw two uniformed pledges charging through two different doors. From both my positions, I observed the bright dust jacket of the book in my visitor's hand, and both the me on the cot and the me in the chair experienced a surge of demand. An endless second later, I was seated beside the immobilized artillery pledge Fletcher as glowing sparks fell and died in the air. I was stark naked and brandished a sort of obdurate erection known at Fortress as Blue Steel. Artillery pledge Fletcher's mouth hung open. I bent forward and closed the door with my fingertips. He recalled why he had come to my room. His trembling hand proffered the book.
I thought I wanted to...
Pledge Fletcher's eyes landed on my erection.
Hey, keep the book. I have to get to mess.
No, you don't, I said. He backed toward the door. I put the book on my desk, stood up, grasped his upper arms, and moved him sideways.
Oh, Christ, he said. Look, I'll get a late-for-mess kick, but if you want to marry, I'll give you one.
A kick with a demerit, and Mary meant a five-finger Mary, school slang for masturbation. I had no idea what I intended to do, apart from ensuring that he never leave the room alive. My freedom slid up the coarse fabric of his tunic, leaving a transparent glister like the track of a snail. Don't cream all over my uniform. He stepped to one side, settled his hand mid-shaft, and not untenderly, moved it up and down as if he were milking a cow.
What was that with the sparks?
I'll explain later. Nuts to the tick. Do me afterwards. Anything you want. My knees locked and my spine straightened. Ivory gout flew across 10 feet of floor and splatted against the window. Artillery pledge Fletcher hooted, playfully aimed me at the ceiling, and pumped on. I released my grip on him, he his on me. A flush mottled his face. He fumbled with his zipper and groped into his trousers. Thanks for the book, Fletcher. Knowing for the first time since my experiments in the ruined house that I could freeze a human heart, I sent an icicle into his. Hand in his fly, Fletcher tumbled dead to the floor. Whatever I decided to do with his body would have to wait until after curfew. I shoved him under the bed and settled down to read. I might as well say, to experience an ecstasy more profound than sexual release. This sage, this prophet, a resident of Providence, Rhode Island, according to the infuriatingly cursory paragraph on the flap, had penetrated the mystery far more deeply than I. But he confirmed the origins of my mission and the nature of my ancestors. He uttered their mighty names, Nyarlathotep, Yog-Sothoth, Shub-Niggurath, Great Cthulhu. The Dunwich Horror became my genesis, my gospels, my gnosis. In wonder and joy, I read through it twice. I looked up and noticed the time was 3 a.m. I reluctantly closed the book, dragged the corpse from beneath my cot, transported it to a colonnade overlooking the dormitory courtyard, and dumped it over the side. There was a four-story drop onto the concrete. Good enough, I thought. In my haste, I neglected to remove Fletcher's hand from his fly. The apparent suicide of a fortress pledge had attracted national attention, but what appeared to be its autoerotic aspect was never officially announced. The autopsy deepened the mystery. Fletcher had died as the result of a massive heart attack, 6 to 12 hours before one or more people had dropped him onto the courtyard. A trace of semen belatedly discovered on his tunic led to the widely reported theory that the cadet had died in the midst of a sex party. The administration's final attempt at dampening the scandal was to announce that a depraved outsider had accosted Artillery Pledge Fletcher on the way to mess hall and had forced him into a remote area of the campus, where the fiend's immoral advances had induced a heart attack, whereupon the fiend had laid in wait until he could so deal with the body as to place suspicion on the innocent. Artillery Pledge Fletcher had submitted to death rather than dishonor. During that time, a certain crucial revelation that was to shape all the rest of my life came to be. Once again, I heard the voice from Johnson's Woods. One day, a day long distant, there would appear in the earthly realm an enemy who would be like a shadow self. When grown to adulthood, he would possess the power to inhibit the coming of the last days. This Antichrist would be most vulnerable when still a child, yet evil forces would conspire to protect him from destruction at my hands. My enemy was also the smoke from the cannon's mouth. He was going to be a member of the family. In fact, he was going to be my son. I was rewarded for my good behavior as a pledge, by the gift of a summer abroad. I idled away the happy hours in the flesh pots of Cannes, Nice, and Monte Carlo. My parents may not have wanted me to come home, but my father, as ever good as his word, engineered by means of a hefty donation, my acceptance to his alma mater, Yale University. An arrest and imprisonment for the petty crime of breaking and entering soon put an end to that, and after release from prison, I embarked upon my wandering career. As a source of funds, I turned instinctively to what is known as racketeering. Crime is a form of study akin to calculus or military philosophy, and like them, yields itself to the superior intellect. Carefully timed use of my powers didn't hurt either, especially when it came to intimidation. Before I was 30, I had become a lord of crime. Yet I grew weary of the constant obligations attendant upon being a lord of crime, and began to feel a midlife crisis. The truth is that I considered myself an artist as well as a criminal. Only a handful of writers, none of them worthy, had taken up the challenge of the author of the Dunwich Horror, the Providence Master, and I wanted to prove myself his only true inheritor. So in my middle years I renounced worldly success and returned to Edgerton, there to pursue my writing while dabbling in whatever I found of interest. The local criminal element welcomed me precisely to the extent I wished. During this period, I moved to the entertaining demimonde of would-be artists and hangers-on to be found in the vicinity of any college or university. Many were the nights when my abode was a scene of lively discussion. Many were the pneumatic girls whose bodies I rode into eye-rolling spasms of bliss at the ends of these nights. After all, if one of my essential tasks was the murder of my son, I first had to create the little darling. Of all the art-infatuated, experiment-minded dumbbells I bedded during this enchanted period of my life, only Star Dunstan managed to get pregnant. For a couple of months, I made cutesy-poo faces and uttered lies about the golden future. Yet there came a night when I went out on a ramble and returned to an empty house. She had scarpered, taken flight. I sought the help of Johnson's Woods and learned that having spoken, the voice was now eternally silent. A month later, I heard that my beloved had turned up back in Edgerton and given birth. Fine, I thought. A few tentative visits accompanied by bouquets of flowers and boxes of chocolate, a statement of total forgiveness, a show of infinite adoration, and she'd be back in an eye blink, the precious lad clamped to a handsome mammary. And I could suffocate my only begotten darling. A few hours later, the arrival on my doorstep of two blue boys instructed me that someone had dropped, as they say, the dime on my participation in a number of illegal activities. A speedy trial led to a second imprisonment, this one in the state facility known as Greenhaven. I took this deprivation with a lighter heart than I would have, for the little darling was still advancing from diapers to the potty, from baby babble to his first lisping excursions into English, and could not for decades pose a threat to my destiny as herald of the apocalypse. I could kill the little beast when I got out, and I positively looked forward to the hunt. Just at the time I grew tired of pampered confinement, a prison riot enabled me to simultaneously exit Greenhaven and guarantee my anonymity. The years have been long and frustrating. The adversary proved as slippery as promised. However, the year I escaped from prison, I found that I had been granted one final, annually bestowed ancestral boon. By the indulgence of the ancient gods, a shadow who was Star Dunstan's son, became present to me each year on his birthday. He has one more birthday left to him. His last. And wherever he is now, whether he slinks and skulks through the hospital corridors, the old houses on Cherry Street, or the Hatchtown taverns, whether he hides himself or walks unknowing through Edgerton's Avenue streets and hidden lanes, that day arrives in exactly 1 week. How I learned about Riverbottom. Aunt Nettie's running shoes slapped against the hard red tiles, and a carpet weave bag the size of a suitcase bounced against her hip. Far down the room, Aunt May turned to the nearest crew member and announced, "That's my niece's son, Ned. He has fits." Aunt Nettie pulled me into an embrace. Through the fabric of her bag, I felt the hard shapes of bottles and jars. Her youthful forehead had been eroded by worry. "It's bad, Ned." Aunt May came toward us, supporting herself on a shiny metal cane. "It does me good to see this boy back in Edgerton." We moved toward cubicle 15. I looked at the curtain in front of the cubicle. "What happened to her?" May leaned toward me. "It was this morning. Dropped down and hit the floor. Clark jumped up and called 911. Aunt Nettie said, "Young as she is, your mother had a stroke." Aunt May's voice grew thinner and sharper. "When did you get back home?"
"About a minute ago. I hitchhiked. I'm still carrying my bags." I pointed at the knapsack and the duffel on the floor beside the entrance. "Is Toby Kraft still around?"
"Last I heard, dogs still have fleas," Aunt Nettie fired back. Technically, Nettie and May had ceased to be Dunstans when they got married, but their husbands had been absorbed into the self-protective world of Cherry Street as if born to it. Queenie's marriage to Toby Kraft and her desertion to his pawn shop had taken place late in her life and only minimally separated her from her sisters.
"Uncle Clark is all right, I hope."
"An expert on everything under the sun, same as ever. Here comes your Uncle Clark."
The old man in the loose yellow shirt coming around the desk bore only a generic resemblance to the man I remembered. His ears protruded at right angles, like Dumbo's, from the walnut of his skull. The whites of his eyes shone the ivory of old piano keys. Uncle Clark drew up in front of his wife like a vintage automobile coming to rest before a public monument.
"How are we doing at the moment?"
"The same," said Aunt Nettie.
He lifted his head to inspect me and moved to the curtain. I followed him inside.
"Your boy is here," he said to my mother. "That should help you pull through. Get yourself back on your feet now, honey."
The curtain swung shut behind him. Star clutched my hand and propelled herself upright.
"Your father."
A nurse brushed me aside to place one hand on my mother's chest.
"Valerie, you have to relax."
My mother licked her lips.
"Robert."
Her eyes closed, and she was instantly asleep. Outside the cubicle, Aunt Nettie lowered her bag onto a table in the visitor's lounge and pulled out sandwiches wrapped in cling film in a Tupperware container filled with potato salad.
"No sense spending good money on cafeteria food."
Clark dumped potato salad onto his plate.
"When did you blow in, Nettie? A couple days ago?"
"This morning," I said. He cocked his head.
"Is that right? I heard something about a big money poker game."
"Nettie, did you win a lot of money?" Aunt May asked.
"I didn't win any money."
Clark took a minuscule bite of his sandwich.
"The game was upstairs in the Speedway Lounge. My friends there treat me like royalty, like a king."
"Friends like that common tramp Piney Woods, I suppose," said Aunt Nettie.
Clark coaxed a pebble of potato salad onto his fork.
"Matter of fact, it was Piney who told me about Nettie winning that money."
"How are Aunt Joy and Uncle Clarence?"
"Clarence and Joy don't get out much," May said.
Clark nibbled at his sandwich.
"My advice is, die young, while you can still enjoy it."
"Tell me about this morning, Uncle Clark," I said.
He leaned back in his chair and aimed his best sneer at me.
"Save the girl's life." "The bell rang about 6 in the morning, Aunt Nettie said. That star, I said to myself, and the poor girl needs her family's loving care."
"The Dunstan blood," Clark said, nodding at me.
As soon as I opened the door, Ned, I could see she was scared.
May said,
according to Joy.
Aunt Nettie glanced at her sister, and sensing an opening, Clark leaned forward.
That girl was never afraid of anything, Clark announced. She knew she was sick. That's what you saw. She knew she was sick, but she was afraid for Ned.
For me?
That's right, May put in. Clark heard her, too.
What did she say?
A terrible thing could happen to my son, and I have to stop it. That's what she said. I also remember she asked Aunt Nettie to get in touch with some of her old friends.
A few minutes later, I jumped into a brief, uncharacteristic lull. This is going to sound funny, but did she mention anything about my father? I think she wants me to know who he was. The aunts exchanged a glance I could not interpret. Aunt Nettie and Aunt May, you took her in and you gave me a home. But you must have felt that my mother brought shame on your family. But I'm not ashamed that Star wasn't married when I was born.
The dickens are you talking about, Clark said.
May said,
Nettie, Star was married when she had you. I saw the papers.
Well, how come she never told me? Why did she give me her name instead of his?
You were more a Dunstan than whatever he was. His name didn't count for anything.
Do you still have the papers?
They'd be long gone by now.
I silently agreed. With the exception of her driver's license, my mother's attitude toward official documents tended toward a relaxation well past the point of carelessness. Let me see if I have this right. Her husband abandoned her shortly before I was born.
It was something like that, Aunt Nettie said.
The women got to their feet. A second later, I joined them. Didn't Star want us to call her friends? Nettie groped through the contents of her bag and brought out a worn black leather book like a pocket diary.
Most of those people don't know how to conduct themselves in a decent home. If you want to waste your time, here's her address book.
Aunt Nettie moved grandly away.
Aunt May, what did Joy say to you this morning?
Oh, Joy made a mistake. I said to her, Joy, you'll never guess, Star's over at Nettie's.
I know, she said. I saw her with my own eyes standing out front and talking to her boy. He's an extremely handsome young man.
Well, I guess that proves it wasn't me.
No, it doesn't, May said. But I know what does. If Star met you outside the house, she wouldn't have asked Aunt Nettie like she did to call you on the telephone.
In Star's address book, I looked for the Edgerton area code. I came up with two names, one of them that of a person in deep disfavor with Aunt Nettie and May. I dialed his number first. A sandpaper voice said, Pawn shop. When I spoke Toby Kraft's name, he said, Who are you expecting, Harry Truman? The impression that Aunt Nettie and May were right to despise their late sister's husband vanished as soon as I had explained myself.
Ned, that's terrible news. How's she doing?
I told him what I could.
Look, I'll be there quick as I can.
Before he could hang up, I said, Toby, Star wanted us to call her old friends, and I wondered if you knew someone who was in her book.
Make it fast.
Suki Teeter.
Yeah, call Suki. Talk about Jugs, she was a champ. She and your mom, they liked each other. Bye.
The former Jug Champ's telephone rang six times. I was about to hang up when she answered. Sweetheart, if you're looking for money, too bad. This is the wrong number. I told her who I was.
Ned Dunstan? I can't believe it. Did Star give you my number?
In a way, I'm calling from St. Anne's Community. I described what had happened that morning.
I'll be there as soon as I put myself together.
After Suki Teeter hung up, I shoved my hands in my pockets and followed the corridor past the glass wall of the gift shop. Half a dozen people stood in a line before the reception desk. A small, fair-haired boy with gleeful blue eyes took in my approach from a stroller.
Bill! Bill!
Honey, his mother said, this isn't Bill. My first impression was that she looked like the female half of a local anchor team. Her beauty and her intelligence were inextricable. Her dark blonde hair had been cut to fall like a veil across her face. Lined up before the information desk with a dozen shapeless Edgertonians in T-shirts and shorts, she seemed unreasonably exotic. She smiled at me. I said, "He's a beautiful boy." The beautiful boy was struggling to pull his feet through the straps of the stroller. "This man is very nice, Cobby, but he isn't Bill." I waved goodbye. Cobby ecstatically waved back, and she met my eyes with a glance that warmed me all across the lobby and outside into the sunlight. Beyond the low stone wall at the far end of the parking lot, the land dropped away to the bank of the slow, brown-gray Mississippi. It struck me that the river crawled along the city's western flank like an unhappy secret. I wondered if the ants had old stories from the days when Edgerton had been a river town. Then, foolishly, I started to wonder if I would ever again see the woman I had met in the lobby. Thinking of the nights ahead, I ducked into the gift shop and picked up a couple of paperback mystery novels. Behind me, a childish voice said, "You're not Bill," and burst into giggles. I smiled at his mother. "We meet again," she said. "Do you know how to find the intensive care unit? Third floor, follow me." We left the shop and turned toward the elevators. "Your new best friend is my son, Cobby, and I'm Lori Hatch. My cleaning woman had an operation yesterday, and I wanted to say hello. You're seeing someone in intensive care, too?" "My mother. I'm Ned Dunstan. Hello." "Hello, Ned Dunstan. I've heard that name before. Do you live here in town?" "No, I'm from New York." Cobby said, "What's your name?" "Ned." Cobby leaned over the strap of the stroller, and in his deepest voice intoned, "I ain't concluded, and so far I ain't jumped." Embarrassed, Lori glanced at me. "He just picks things up and repeats them. He must be part tape recorder." I grinned. "He has great ears. If he doesn't make it as a comedian, he could always be a musician." His father would have a heart attack. She startled me with a look so charged with resentment, it felt like the touch of a branding iron. "We're separated," she explained. "He'd even hate my bringing Cobby to St. Anne's." "Doesn't your husband approve of St. Anne's?" "Stewart's on the board at Lawndale. He thinks you can contract a virus just by looking at this place." When we reached the ICU, I swung open one of the big doors to let her pass through. I pointed to a notice. "Children are not permitted entry." "Oh, no. Cobby, you'll have to wait for me. I won't be more than a couple of minutes, I promise." "I'll stay with Cobby," I said. "No problem." "I want to stay with Ned," Cobby announced. Through the window, I could see Lori Hatch approaching a cubicle, and Aunt May stumping toward the nurse's station. Aunt May gave the nurse's station a close inspection, leaned over the counter, and snatched a stapler off a desk. She shoved the stapler into her bag. She moved down the counter and took a pad of paper and a pencil from another desk. Soon, Lori came back through the doors. "Did you two have a nice time while I was gone?" Whatever I was going to say disappeared into a sudden whirlwind of physical sensation. A woman's body was swarming over mine. Hair slid across my face and teeth nipped the base of my neck. An odor of sweat and perfume swam into my nostrils. Lori's smile faded. The hands hanging at my sides kneaded the buttocks of the woman on top of me. A breast offered its nipple to my mouth. My tongue lapped the nipple. The woman above me tilted her hips, and I began moving in and out of her. I cleared my throat. "Yeah, I'm all right. I guess I didn't get enough sleep last night." "I don't want to leave if you're ill." "I'm restored, honest." I went to the outer door and opened it for her. Still puzzled, Lori got behind the stroller. "The look on your face, it was like you were eating the most delicious ice cream in the world, but it gave you that ache in the middle of your forehead. Pleasure and pain. No wonder you thought I was sick." Okay. I was stressed out, I told myself. At a time when thinking about anything but Star's plight made me feel guilty, a good-looking stranger named Lori Hatch had unknowingly pushed my buttons and induced a 10-second meltdown. On the other hand, maybe I was heading for another bizarre crack-up. I glimpsed the entry into the ICU of a woman with reddish-brown hair bushed out around a kindly, roguish moon face. Suki Cheater looked like a visiting Maharani. I held out my hand. You have to be Suki Cheater. She engulfed me in a hug. I would have been here earlier, but I practically had to recite the Gettysburg Address to get my car out of the shop. She stepped back.
My God! You're a marvel, that's what you are. Tell me everything.
I had nearly finished when Aunt Nettie swept the curtain aside and billowed out. May a step behind her.
Aunt Nettie, have you ever met Star's old friend, Suki Cheater?
We met. You flicked cigarette ashes all over my porch.
Suki said,
I'm very sorry about Star, Aunt Nettie, and went into the cubicle.
Minutes later, Aunt Nettie scorched me with a look of the sort usually described as baleful.
You called Toby Kraft.
I thought he should know. Coming toward us in an ugly plaid jacket too heavy for the weather was a man with a gray, pockmarked face, Coke bottle glasses, and a body like a cigar butt. Suki Cheater parted the curtain and wrapped her arms around me.
Call me if anything changes.
She wiped her eyes and began moving up the aisle. Toby's eyes, the size of eggs behind his thick glasses, focused on the front of her tunic. Close up, Toby's face looked like cottage cheese.
Good sport, that girl. Loyal as the day is long. Hi, kid. Thanks for calling. How's Star doing?
I gave him a brief description.
What a lousy deal. I'll let her know I'm here.
May said,
I'll come with you.
She took his arm and the two of them disappeared through the curtain.
Aunt Nettie, I whispered, you must know that your sister is taking things from the nurse's desks. What's going on? These people, if they want writing supplies, they go to the storeroom and get for free what would cost us $10 at the store. May helps level out the balance. And you're Dunstan. You have to stand by your own people. May is the best magpie in the world. Has been ever since Queenie passed away.
Queenie?
Queen of the Magpies. How do you think she got that name? Your grandmother could leave a store, a colored television set under one arm, pulling a dishwasher on a handcart with the other, and the manager would hold the door and wish her good morning.
Toby came out.
Keep in touch, you hear? You staying at Aunt Nettie's?
I nodded.
If it gets tight over there, I can find you a room in a good, clean place, no problem. And if you could use a couple extra bucks, maybe I'll want some help in the shop. On account of you remind me of your mama.
I'll keep it in mind, Toby. Dinner consisted of the same sandwiches, pickles, and potato salad as lunch. Clark negotiated a white pebble onto his fork.
Heard about you, boy. Remember my mention of Piney Woods? I ran into Piney this afternoon. $600, he said.
Is that right?
A fellow named Joe Staggers and three of his friends are looking to get it back.
Clark sent me another yellow glance.
They's the Mountry boys. You don't want to mess with boys from Mountry.
Uncle Clark, I never met anyone named Joe Staggers. I don't play cards, and I'm tired of hearing about it. Before the change of shift, I wandered up to the counter and noticed that my duffel had been partially unzipped. Nothing seemed to be missing. I went to the desk.
Nurse, did you see anyone touch my bag or open it up?
Only you, she said.
After 7 p.m., Star kept rising toward clarity and fading back. My aunt told her she needed sleep. I thought my mother needed to talk to me, and that was why she never let go of my hand. Do you want to tell me about my father? She gasped with frustration. Was his name Robert? She groaned. I thought that's what you were telling me before. She summoned her powers.
Not Edward.
What was his last name? She sat there and met my eyes with a glance that nearly lifted me off the floor.
Reinhardt.
A name came to me from the furthest reaches of my childhood. Reinhardt? The night nurse erupted through the curtain and threw me out, but not before I saw Star Nod. Inside her house on Cherry Street, Aunt Nettie placed herself on the old davenport, dumped her bag on the floor, peeked inside, and folded it shut again. Clark gave me a wary glance from the easy chair. May sat beside Aunt Nettie with a deep sigh. I dropped my bags next to the staircase and took the rocking chair. Does Edward Reinhardt mean anything to you? My aunts exchanged a glance, almost too brief to be seen. May said, Do you know that name, Nettie? I do not, Aunt Nettie replied. What's got in that bag? Clark asked. The seat cushion between my aunts disappeared beneath a mound of pens and pencils, pads of paper, scissors, paper clips, antihistamines, and nasal steroids in sample packets. It was like going to the circus and watching the clowns pile out of the little car. The sisters began dividing the plunder into two equal piles, now and then adding things to a third, smaller share. Aunt Nettie floated into the kitchen and returned with two grocery bags, one to hold May's spoils and the other for the smaller pile. Ned, after you see May home, you can drop this off at Joy's. I'll leave some lights on. I helped May down the steps. Don't you ever worry about getting caught, Aunt May? May shook her head. Nettie, I'm too good to get caught. Now hush up, because talking brings bad luck. And hush up about that other thing, too, if you know what's good for you. I don't get it. We're talking about a man who disappeared 35 years ago. I'll have to hush up for both of us, then. She did not say another word until she thanked me for accompanying her home. Next door, a bent, osteoporotic Joy accepted her bag of goodies and so hesitantly asked me in that my refusal came as a relief to us both. I promised to visit the following afternoon. Inside Aunt Nettie's house, I carried my bags upstairs. I unzipped the duffel. The next day's clothing went on the seat of a rush chair, my blazer over its back. The bed springs yelped when I stretched out. I noticed my blazer drooped to one side, weighted by something in its right pocket. I reached into the pocket and pulled out a thick wad of bills. It added up to $576. I thought I should tear the bills into confetti and flush them down the toilet. In the end, I pushed the money into a front pocket of my knapsack. For the first time in years, unconsciousness pulled me into my recurring nightmare. In my earlier years, the dream began with the shadow ripping the seams that connected us, and ended with the shadow's gesture toward the forest. Later, I pursued my shadow through the trees. Monstrous beings launched themselves from overhanging rocks, dug claws into my shoulders, and fastened their jaws around my neck. Years later, a hitherto unexpected dream capacity kept me from jolting out of sleep, the ability to defeat the monsters. When the dream self had finally come to trust its capacity for survival, the dream went away. But as if I were 20 again, I followed the shadow through a deep wood. A sparse rain patted onto the leaves overhead. 20 or 30 yards away, the woods ended in a wall of thick oaks marking the boundary of a meadow. A thunderclap boomed, and the air filled with the sound of wingbeats. A jagged branch of lightning tore through the sky and illuminated the landscape. I saw that I had come nearer the border of the woods than I had imagined. 20 feet of woodland and half as many trees stood between me and a broad field ending at a road. The road would get me back to Edgerton, but I was worried about Star, and the storm was going to delay my return to the hospital. Another lightning bolt shattered the sky. I made out a tall portico and a stone facade with shuttered windows. A vertical column of lightning erased the darkness. I charged onto open ground and kept running until I reached the stone slab beneath the portico. I wrapped my hand around the metal knocker and slammed it down. A lock clicked. Soft light spilled out. I'm sorry to bother you, I said to the person invisible behind the door. I was caught in the rain, and I wondered if I could use your telephone. A man leaned into the darkness to hold the door, and I stepped across the threshold. The door slammed shut. A lock resoundingly clicked. My host's almost entirely familiar eyes shone in triumph.
although the utter striking handsomeness of the man before me in no way resembled the way I looked. His individual features, taken one by one, mysteriously replicated my own. The shadow stood before me and laughed at my helplessness. I cried out and shuddered awake.